The big issue is current drain, not so much from the digital reception part of it, but from the display part of it. Your Watchman that you currently have, you're going to throw away. You're not going to carry around a little pocket-sized converter. I don't think anybody's thinking that way. Because even the USB key doesn't have the display electronics in it because you're using your laptop or your computer for that. So, I mean, you are using some processing power of the microprocessor to turn that stuff into pictures. It does draw some current. It's not, it's still a little bit power hungry. The best portable one that I've seen now, the batteries only last for like 5 or 6 hours or 4 hours, whatever it is. And it's a pretty hefty-sized battery, but it's coming down.
Okay, another station on channel. I think you said there's a whole bunch of digital reception Watchman-like sets that I can buy now that are battery-operated, up to 5 hours on that battery. All right, Joe, were you saying there's another person on channel?
Yeah, I think W2PW check, try to check in.
Okay, W2PW. Okay, that was Briss. Go ahead, Briss.
Thanks, Joe, and thank you for again, W2PW. I was going to comment on those USB sticks. Actually, it's funny, just before you brought it up. They have both ATSC and MTSC units in them. They take considerably more processing power of a laptop to process digital. So I'm on the order of twice or more. Like, it requires a 900 megahertz Pentium CPU to watch ATS of NTSC, requires a 2.5 to 3 gigahertz processor to watch ATSC. So I'm thinking that there's an awful lot of decoding that's offloaded to the laptop itself. Eric, W2PW.
Yeah, you're right about that. The little USB keys only spit out the results of after passing through the equalizer, the IMQ. You still have to take the stream apart, select the channel, put the packets together, separate the audio from the video, and make that work. So you need some processing power. That's why the portable sets are a little power hungry at this stage of the game. It's not like you're just running a display that you are feeding an analog signal into.
That portable set that gives you 5 hours of operation, how big is that battery? If I'm a sufficiently enthusiastic guy, can I go to the beach with a lead-acid battery and run it for a longer period of time, in your opinion?
Yeah, if you bring a lead-acid cell, a couple of gel cells, you can get lots of time out of it. I don't know what the power drain is. I think it's something like 40 watts, 50 watts, something like that. But the batteries that they sell with it, that lithium ion, rechargeable, I think they're like 1600 milliamp batteries, and they last anywhere between 3 and 5 hours, depending upon whose set it is. And of course, they always say it lasts longer than it really does. So, it's the current. There's a lot of stuff that's got to go on, because once you've turned the RF into digits, then you have to take the stream apart. So. That's where it really gets power hungry.
Okay, so the Pentium microprocessor running at 2.5 gig rate is one of the big power hungry circuits, and I guess the other is the cold cathode fluorescent light. That's got to be bright enough to be able to be seen at high noon on a beach, and that must be drawing some power. Are those two of the main places where you think the current is going? Eric, go ahead.
Well, the efficiency of small displays, look at your iPod, okay, that's got a cold cathode display behind the LCD. The LCD draws nothing. That draws microamps. The light bulb draws a little bit of juice. But they're going to OLEDs, they're organic LEDs now, and they, your typical LED that you would normally use in a panel is what, 15 to 20 milliamps. The organic LEDs are like a quarter of a mil. So they're actually going to these OLED displays, which is reducing the power consumption and actually making a brighter picture than the fluorescent tubes do.
When I'm on the beach in the summertime, I have a hell of a lot of ambient light. Is it possible to make a light-emitting diode No, liquid crystal. Is it possible to make a liquid crystal-like display where the external illumination supplies the illumination and I don't have to supply it internally as a backlight, so to speak? Has anyone ever done that to your knowledge, Eric?
Yeah, actually, there's a lot of devices out there where there's a piece of opal glass on the back of it, and you just kind of point it up at the sun, and it you see the display. They also make liquid crystal displays with the super black. Don't forget that in order to see a liquid crystal display, you have to have a polarizing filter in front of it. I mean, that's the way it works. So, they have various different kinds of lenticular filters on the front to take advantage of the ambient light. So, but the in terms of brightness of through the liquid crystal, the LEDs and OLEDs are brighter than the fluorescents are. And actually, in the broadcast industry, we have a display that goes outdoors that's bright as all hell. You can see it in bright sunlight.
I got a comment on the Watchman, Dick.
Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, the little Watchman I'm talking about has a regular CRT in it that sits and a little reflective mirror inside there. It's got a flyback in it. It's got a yoke on that little tube, and it set back the tube in such a way that you're like looking into it, and you can see it in very bright sunlight, Dick. Over.
Yeah, that's a Sony Watchman.
Could I have a kind of display, liquid crystal, where the light is coming from the back, shining through the liquid crystal into a polarizer screen, color display, where behind the screen it's got partial transparency, and the manufacturer has given me a mirror where I position the mirror the right way so that the sun shines on the mirror and the sunlight goes through the liquid crystal transparent display. Although that would be a little bit of a pain in the neck and some people wouldn't be able to do it, to use it correctly, particularly on that on a cloudy day. Has anyone ever done that? Would that give me a fairly bright display that doesn't require a whole lot of power? Over to you, Eric.
Got one.
No, I've never heard of one with a mirror that you actually adjust so you can put it down and capture the sunlight. But there's even some computers that have a piece of opal glass on the backside and allows the ambient light to be used without having to have a light source behind it. But I don't see that in television displays because in order to get the colorimetry right, you have to have a known color temperature source. And as you know, the color temperature of God's light varies from anywhere from about 2,000 degrees to 6,700 degrees, depending upon the time of day, so that wouldn't be too good.
But Mel said he's got one. Let the machine reset and tell us about the one you've got, Mel. Hello, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. Just ran and got that little TV. I got one. It's a Casio. I'll get it. Fine. I know it's in the drawer. It's called a Casio Pocket Television TV 200. Cute little thing. Has let's see how many batteries in it, and it's got an antenna on it, and you have to use a headphone. Takes two AA batteries, and it has two options. You either open this little cover. It opens up, and it's got like a transparency on one side, and the liquid crystal's inside the lid, and it reflects back onto a mirror, Dick, and you don't have to use the backlight on it if you have some out light, like in the room and all over.
Is it black or white or color?
Color.
Wow. What year did you buy that, Mel, and roughly how many bucks then?
Oh, I got this thing as a gift. Let me see, how long ago did I get this thing? Gee, I bet you 10, 12 years ago, Dick, over.
BW had one in the late 80s.
Who had one in the late 80s?
W2 Papa Whiskey, I had one in probably 85. Yeah, early to mid, I'd say 85, 87, I had one a little better.
And Press, are you still using it? Has it given you good service?
Well, you know, you got to remember, living out in Southern County, there's almost no television reception out here. 55 and 67 were the only things that came in strong. Now, 55 analog's off the air already. 21 was okay, but there wasn't a prayer of getting anything from the city. So the answer is it's more of a curiosity for traveling. And I lost it or got rid of it or sold it many years ago.
Did you actually ever use it for a moving vehicle?
Oh, yeah. But as I think what Mel would confirm, they're sort of a fussy little affair. If you didn't have the backlight, you better be outside. They look, you know, the brighter the light, the better they look. But in a regular room, it was pretty shabby if you didn't have the backlight.
Just a quick question. Couldn't get any signal from the city. Couldn't you get any signals from Connecticut, that being in eastern Long Island? Probably know about that, Dick, in TGO2.
Okay. Let's see if... you never got any Connecticut channels there, Press?
No. South Shore, you know, Connecticut is, from a WIPET kind of standpoint, it's not usable. Inside the house or even walk around the park, the only thing that came in was 67 and 55, you know, 55 now gone. You got barely something from 21, and that's about it. Nothing Connecticut.
Dick? Go ahead.
Most of Connecticut's broadcasts are in Hartford, so it's a pretty good sell. Even people that are on the coastline of Connecticut's shoreline, some people have difficulty. I mean, there is a station in Bridgeport, there's another station in Water Bay, but most of it's centered around Hartford, so, you know, it's a good sell.
Okay. Let's see if Kent is there. Channel 2, TBS Television in Dallas. I am guessing they're going over to Channel 2 Digital. Am I correct or incorrect on that one, Ken? W5VJB, if you're there. K2RIW.
No, I don't think he's with us. N2SDU's link has been dropping, and I think he just got frustrated at some point.
Do you know about that TBS Channel 2? In Dallas, you think there's a chance they're going to go digital after February?
No, there isn't a chance they're going digital. They have to go digital. Where they're going, I think I read you the list last week. I don't think there's anybody on Channel 2. I think the lowest channel in the Dallas area is either 5 or 8, I forget. But I can look it up for you again.
Okay, so 5 is VHF low. So there are some digital TV VHF lows. Not many, but a couple, and Dallas might be one of them.
Give me a second, I'll tell you exactly.
Okay, while we're waiting, Mel, you want to go to a letter? It's your choice. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Now, I've just looked at this little TV in regular light, in the room light here, in the kitchen. I get nice TV reception on this. Well, they call it the... pocket television, Casio pocket television, Dick. And the cute thing is, like I say, you can slip it in your pocket. It's a little contraption that really works fairly well. Too bad it won't be working anymore. Not that I really use it much, but a couple times it just came in handy with certain circumstances. I was working on this, this thing that we drew last week, and a number of people are interested in hearing what this all means, so I'd like to continue with that at least some time. Over.
Okay. You had us draw those two sine waves 90 degrees apart. You could start from that point or do a quick catch-up and let it drop once in a while when Eric comes back to give us the information he's looking for. You got it, Mel.
Okay. We drew the two waves, as Dick just said. And I think it was up to telling you where how to mark them. Between the zero line on the left, you have the 180-degree line in the center. Next to the 180-degree line, to the left of it, is a 90-degree line we made. And next to that, we made a zero line. Between that zero line and the 180-degree line, mark that half wave, that distance half wave. And going from the 180 degree line to the right, you'll see a 270 line, and parallel to that, a 360 line. Between the 180 and the 360, mark that a half wave. Now make one more horizontal line to measure the distance that would go from zero, from all the way over to the left, to zero line, straight across to the 360, and mark that distance one wavelength. Now, if you do all that, you are looking basically at a graph of the voltage and current distribution of a half-wave wire. And that is basically how it looks with the, you notice the E maximum going over to the 180 degrees, where it goes through E minimum at 90 and then back to E max at 180. And we look at the I minimum at the end at the zero, going to I max at 90, and then going back to down to zero at I minimum at the 180, and then repeating itself. So this is really a good representation of voltage and current waveforms on a wire antenna extended out to one wavelength. Dick, this is what I was going to build on, over.
And that's one wavelength of wire, which is a somewhat rare antenna. Most of the antennas we put up is only half wave long, so therefore some portion of that total curve is what the half wave antenna sees. Over to you, Mel.
Jeff, actually you drew two halves here. You'll notice the 0 to 180 is a half, and from the 180 to the 360 is another half, and the total is one wavelength. But if we examine just the half wavelength point, we can see how the voltage goes from at the center, the voltage is at the 90 degrees minimum, whereas the current is maximum, which would represent basically that if we look at this from 0 to 180 degrees, we're looking at a half wavelength wire antenna stick with the voltage and current distribution over it. Oh, that's what I was showing, and then if we extend it out to the furthest point, we're just repeating it over.
And in theory, you could make two collinear antennas out of that, although they're operating out of phase with each other, so it would give you a null broadside. You'd have to do something else to make it come out right. But if I take a look at the 0 to 180 point, where I get current maximum in the center at the 90 degree point, zero current at the 0 and the 180 point, I get a positive maximum voltage at the 0 point, I get a negative maximum voltage at the 180 point, and I get 0 volts in the center of the half-wave dipole at the 90 degree point. So that's showing me the voltage distribution and the current distribution on a half-wave dipole. And we've taken a snapshot of that signal at one instant of time. 180 degrees later in time, 180 degrees later in time, the current and the voltage are both opposite in polarity. Over to you, Mel.
I got it, Dick.
Okay. Is channel 2 going to be digital?
No, the question is not, is it going to be digital? What's the lower digital channel? In the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the lowest channel is 8.
Do you think anybody, anywhere in the USA, is using VHF low 226 for digital after February?
Okay, the station in Fredericksburg, which is channel 2 analog, will be channel 5. That's the lowest that I've seen in Texas, but I can look through the whole list and see if there's anybody lower anywhere else. I'm sure I'll come across one somewhere. I know there's a few. There's not many, but there's a couple, because most people don't want to deal with the terrestrial noises.
My next question is going to be, what would motivate a broadcast station to transmit VHF low on digital?
Primarily to maintain their branding. If they were on Channel 5 analog, they'd want to be on Channel 5 digital. Actually, the number of your station, that used to be the big thing. You know, there are certain channel numbers that were the most desirable. You know, channel 2 in some places is the most desirable, and channel 13 in other places is the most desirable. It's all psychology, but, oh, here's one that's on channel 2. It's in Las Vegas. The NTSC is on channel 3, but the digital is going to be on channel 2.
Wow. And it sounds like they're going to continue to do that. Impressive. Now, because of the way the box gathers the information that's transmitted in digital and can display on the screen anything you like, the real frequency region could be, let's just take Fox, for instance. Fox, if they wanted to, could transmit on, let me pick a number, channel 9, but the display you'll see is channel 5. Therefore, the branding to the not-too-smart consumer would be the same. So they don't have to go to that frequency in order to keep the branding. Over to you, Eric.
Oh, that's very true. I mean, we can make the display anything you want it to be, as long as it's not in conflict with someone else. There is something in the ATSC protocol that specifies that CISA transmit identification system descriptor. That actually has the frequency assignment in it, and it has a number which is actually given out by the MSTV, or the Maximum Service TV organization. But I'm just looking through the list at some interesting things here. Was like in Juneau, Alaska, there is a station on channel 3, they're moving to channel 10, but their ERP is 1 kilowatt. I like that. 1 kilowatt. You can plug that into your bathroom and have enough power. But the guys on the lowries tend to be where there's a lot of land space. So, you know, if you want big coverage area, I think you want to be in the lowries. And anybody that's in the V's, I've also noticed there's some UHFs that got down into the V's, and I think what that does is it's going to improve their coverage area. As we get away from the big cities like New York and these sort of places where there's a high density population, as you get into the Midwest where you have to cover hundreds of miles, I think being in the VHF region is desirable for these folks.
In theory, if they made the antenna the same effective capture area on UHF as it is on VHF, they would have fairly similar range because the transmitting antenna has got more gain capability. But an awful lot of our UHF antennas are very simple structures without a whole lot of gain. I suspect that a significant number of people are using that simple loop of wire on the back of the set for UHF reception that in the old days was shipped with the TV. And that leaves a lot to be desired for its location, gain, directivity, whatever. Okay, I'm going to send it back to Mel. And go ahead and add to this diagram as you like. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Anybody have any questions about the first diagram before we start another one about how the relationship of bulge and current along a half-wave wire acts? Any questions about it? No questions? What we can do is we can look more closely at what is taking place and do a, as they say, an in-depth study of basically the current distribution of a half-wavelength wire. So to do that, you need a piece of paper again. And on a piece of paper, holding it, an 8x10 paper, hold it, the 10 length of the paper horizontal, make it easier. And just draw a horizontal line straight across again, across the paper horizontally. And then in the middle of the paper, erect a vertical line in the middle and mark that one, that middle one, up on top of quarter wave, this middle wire, middle line that we just drew, mark that a quarter wave. Now go to the left, go an inch or so, inch and a quarter to the left, and make another vertical line, mark that 1/8 wavelength, and then repeat it again, parallel to that, same distance to the left of that, and mark that zero, that vertical line. So far, any questions? Over. Okay. Next thing we do, now to the right, where we have the center, the quarter wavelength mark, go approximately the same distance over to the right, the inch, go inch and a quarter, whatever you decided, and mark, put a vertical line there, and mark that 3/8 wavelength, and then continue over again from the 3/8, another straight line parallel to that same distance over, and mark that half wavelength. So, any questions so far of what we're doing? Okay, now, dial back, let's go back over to the left, the zero line that we made. Go up on that zero line, about 3/4 of an inch up, make a mark there. Go to the 1/8 that's to the right of it, and about a little bit above halfway up that line, say 3/4 of an inch up, make another mark, and go over to the quarter wave and make a mark about an inch up on there. And next, the 3/8, make another mark the same height above the 3/8 on that line as you did on the 1/8 line, or about 3/4 of an inch up from the zero line. And the same thing, now go over to the 1/2 wavelength, that's to the right of it, and make a mark about an inch up, a mark there. Any questions? Now, from the line, the zero line, where we made that mark up there, I want you to mark that line, that point there, E, and put under it 1,000 volts at that mark. Mark that E. 1,000 volts. And now going straight down to the zero line point on the same line, the zero first line, where we just put that E equals 1,000 volts, put down there I equals 0.2 amperes. Any questions on that? Now, go over to the middle where we made the mark about approximately an inch above the line, where the half that we marked at a quarter wavelength, and mark at that mark, I want you to mark that I equals 2 amperes, 2A. And right below that, where the line, the quarter line, crosses the zero, mark that E at that point equals 100 volts. And now, continuing on, go over to the right where we have the half wavelength. Mark that, at that point, 1 inch above it, the line, where we made the mark, mark that E equals 1,000. And straight down below it, where the line, the 1/2 wave line, crosses the zero line, mark that mark it I equals 0.2 M. Any questions? Okay, now, starting over now, back over to the left there, where zero, and E was 1,000, we want to make a slight curve going down and crossing right through where we marked the E, where we made that little mark on the 1/8 wavelength line to the right of it. So we made a little mark there. You make a gradual curve down, and the curve will stop at the center quarter wavelength where we marked that E equals 100 volts. Right at that point, we want to make that a... this curve end at that point. Any questions on that? Okay, continuing from that point, E, we want to repeat the same curve going up. In other words, it looks like we're making a wing. Going to continue up, go through the 3/8 mark where we made that little mark on the 3/8, and continue up with the curve until we get to the half wave and where we marked that E equals 1,000 volts. Any questions? Okay, now one more curve we're going to make. Starting over on the left, where we have I equals 0.2 amperes, I want to start a curve going straight through the quarter starting from the zero point where I equals 0.2 amp, curving up, going through that point on the 1/8, crossing at that point. In other words, you're going to have actually a crossing spot like that. Continuing this curve up to the quarter wavelength mark in the middle where we mark the 2 amp. At that point, we're going to continue with the curve down, go through the 3/8 where we made the mark, down to the half wavelength where we marked it, I equals 0.2 amps. In other words, it looks like a curve, a complete curve, like part of a circle. Any questions? I think I sort of described it correctly. Over. Okay. Seeing there's no questions on it. Okay. What we have now, we're looking at an in-depth study of the voltage and current distribution of the half-wave wire. Now, for illustration, what I did is actually I made a 10-to-1 ratio of voltage to and current, so that would be easy to do some figuring. Now, we just apply Ohm's law. E over I, instead of in this case, we're going to make it equal to Z, which is basically impedance. So write E over I equals Z. Now let's look at it a little closer and we'll see something very interesting. How we determine, you know, impedance, how it happens to come out to the figures that we are very familiar with. So first, E over I equals Z. Everybody's got that, I hope, written down? Okay, if we apply that and we look at the zero line where we've got 1,000 volts and 0.2 amperes, applying that to the formula, you'll notice that we got 1,000 divided by 0.2, we got 5,000 ohms impedance at the end. Z would equal 5,000 ohms. If we go over to the middle and we apply the same formula at the middle, what happens? We've got, there it is, E, the voltage, is 100 volts, I is 2 amperes, our Z will come out to 50 ohms. Now, there is basically an in-depth look of how the impedance at the center will be 50 ohms and what the impedance will look like hypothetically towards the end of our half-wave dipole. And, of course, it repeats itself right across. In fact, you can also do the math and get the impedance at the 1/2 wavelength or a 3/8 or whatever you like to go, quarter, 3/8. Am I making it fairly clear, Dick? Over.
I think so. Just some of the height of the marks on each of the lines was a little less than clear. And the volts and currents that you drew, these are absolute magnitudes, not, in other words, absolute values of volts, not necessarily the real volts on the left side and the right side. In other words, left side and right side is going to have opposite polarity voltage, but I think you're writing down the magnitude of the voltage. In other words, if it's been rectified. Over to you, Mel.
Roger, for illustration, I kept it within what they call basically a convenient, 10-to-1 ratio for both voltage and current, Dick. Over.
Okay, so now you're proving to us that you've got something like 5,000 ohms at the tip and something like 50 ohms in the center.
Exactly. So this is what takes place basically on a half wave. Now, we can go a little bit further. If we were to go back to the original diagram and put instead in the center where we have this 0 to 360, if we set that with a piece of coax going from 0 to 360, and in other words, if we drew a double line in the middle there so that and call that a piece of coax cable, we could actually now represent what happens now on a piece of transmission line, Dick. Over.
Absolutely. And what goes on a transmission line is a quite a mystery to a lot of people. And that's what the Smith chart is trying to make a little bit more clear, that if there's any standing wave on that line, the actual impedance you measure at various places will be different. Turns out an antenna is a standing wave structure, so it's got different impedances at different places along the dipole, and a transmission line that has any reflective power also has different impedances that you could measure at various locations along the transmission line, and a Smith chart tries to make that clearer. Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, that's what I try to get through. So now, if we look at this original chart, the 0 to 360, you can see the transmission line will change impedance values at its ends. It clarified what happened. So we'll notice that the bulge in the current basically distribution along a transmission line are the same as it would be along an antenna. As a result, the impedances at the end of a half wave line are the same while the quarter wave line inverts. I hope I didn't make that as clear, but I have a feeling that I may have lost everybody. Actually I'm trying to really show the beauty of a piece of transmission line capabilities of going through, what's the right word, through its transition and using it, basically how we able to use a transmission line just as Dick, over.
Yeah, quarter wave matching transformer or as an equivalent inductor or as an equivalent capacitor. The right length of transmission line with a short or an open at the far end of it, used in series or in parallel, can represent a very high power capacitor or a very high power inductor. And quite a few antennas use a length of transmission line where the far end is either shorted or opened as a synthesized inductor or synthesized capacitor at high power with very low loss in order to impedance match the antenna. And there's a zillion ways of doing that. The Smith chart will help you understand some of those. Over to you, Mel. K2LIW.
Exactly. This is K2KEY. So, since the transmission line can change the impedances, that is why that we can use a piece of... That's why I... Again, getting back to the Smith chart, how we can take the length of coax cable and actually use it in a way as a sub, or in fact you can make it alter your FWR by changing the length of the transmission line. So this basically I went through it with the Smith chart, how if you have to come up with a method of tuning up the situation at a field day and all, if you understand what is happening there with a length of transmission line, which acts as the same as the half wavelength wire, you can see that the proper application of a piece of transmission line can actually act as your matching type device. This is basically what you're seeing on a transmission line, like you're looking at the same thing as this original diagram, over.
I think you're saying you got quite a few letters on this subject of what you started last week, Mel.
This is where the misunderstanding completely. What is the, how, what takes place on the, on a piece of half-wave, run-of-the-mill dipole, what actually takes place? And you'll be amazed that when told them about how many times that signal has to transverse on this wire back and forth, they thought we're really crazy, Dick, over.
All the good books will call a half-wave dipole, or any dipole, a standing wave structure. The only way you have a standing wave on a transmission line or a standing wave on a piece of wire is there must be a signal flowing from left to right and another signal flowing from right to left. And in some cases, it's the exact same signal. And so a standing wave structure really has energy bouncing back and forth in it. And by that token, any resonator, and by the way, the half-wave dipole is a kind of resonator, obvious by the fact that you can sweep the frequency, or you can sweep the length, and watch it go from capacitive to inductive. In either case, if you put an inductor and a capacitor in parallel with each other as a resonant network, believe it or not, that's also a standing wave structure, although a lot of books won't call it that. But at one instant, you've obviously got a resonant frequency of an inductor and a capacitor, and the frequency of resonance, you can predict it ahead of time, 1 over 2 pi times square root of L and C. That's all. The 1 over 2 pi and the square root of L and C, that's all in the denominator. It's just a 1 in the numerator. And that's the frequency of resonance. When you're at the resonant frequency, at one instant of time, as the voltage on the capacitor will say, goes from minimum up to maximum, back to minimum, and negative maximum, and back to minimum, which is the first curve that Mel drew. At the instant the voltage is maximum on the capacitor of an LC network, the stored energy in the capacitor, in joules, has the formula 1/2 CV squared. 1/2 of the capacitance in farads times the voltage squared, where the voltage is in volts. That's the stored energy. At the maximum voltage instant of time, all the energy is in the capacitor. Let me drop. A quarter of a cycle later, the voltage on the capacitor is sweeping through zero, and the current in the inductor is maximum. When the voltage on the capacitor is sweeping through zero, because there's a sine wave of resonance going on there, zero energy is stored in the capacitor at that instant. But the current in the inductor is maximum at that instant. Stored energy in joules in an inductor is 1/2 L I squared, inductance in Henry, times current in amperes squared. So you can see that the energy bounces back and forth between inductor and capacitor twice on each cycle of the sine wave of resonance. You could say the energy is bouncing back and forth between inductor and capacitor. You can draw the sine wave of voltage or the sine wave of current on either one, and each instant of time you can calculate how much energy is in each. Strong similarity between a inductor and capacitor as a resonator, or a half wavelength piece of wire as a dipole. In either case, there's voltages and currents going up and down on each cycle. Impedances are changing. Impedances are constant, but there is energy bouncing back and forth between the tips of the dipole, just like there's energy bouncing back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor of a resonator network. You'd be amazed how many circuits have that characteristic, energy bouncing back and forth. You could say everything that resonates, I don't care if it's a cavity resonating filter, I don't care if it's the inductors and capacitors that are in an ordinary lumped filter, I don't care if it's the equivalent capacitance and inductance you've got within a transmission line that has a standing wave, or if it's the dipole itself. Energy is bouncing back and forth. I think you could clearly say everything that resonates has bouncing energy. K2KUY, K2LIW.
Very good. This is K2KEY. Okay, let's just clarify a little bit more. Gabe came up with some very good points. Looking at that first diagram where we now superimpose a piece of transmission line on it, you'll notice that the voltage and current repeat. Actually, note the impedance values repeat in multiples of 180 degrees. Or, well, as we're looking at there, or twice per wavelength. Now, why is this so important to understand? Because you notice that one thing we can do with a piece of transmission line that's amazing, we can make what Dick always referred to as the poor man's Balaam. And if, for instance, we have a antenna, a loop antenna, and a delta loop, and it has a 75 ohm type of impedance, we can convert it very easily from 75 to 50 ohms just by using a piece of 50 ohm coaxial cable rolled up and make ourselves a Dalem right there, a four-man Dalem, basically, just a few number of turns of cable, and there we are, and we can actually, if you want, we can use a section of the 75-ohm cable, take the calculated length, a quarter wavelength plus the velocity factor, and we can transform the delta of feed point impedance, basically, to 50 ohms. If that's what we want to see, because we'd like to see maybe the SWR, reduce the SWR from, would be, if we left at 75 ohms, which is not a bad thing, the SWR would be 1.5 to 1. If we, of course, want to get it closer to 1 to 1, we just do this transformation by a piece of coax. I think that's a good example of the application of this, Dick, over.
Yeah, the Balun you're talking about, B-A-L-U-N, most people pronounce it Balun, which is a contraction of balanced and unbalanced. If you made it a quarter wavelength long, it would be an impedance inverter, and the correct impedance for that piece of cable is each impedance multiplied together, and you take the square root. If I take 75 ohms, which is the antenna, and 50 ohms, which is my transmission line, multiply them together and take the square root, I end up with 61 ohms. So if the quarter wavelength of line that's doing the impedance matching happens to be 61 ohms in impedance at the center frequency of this antenna, the impedance match will be perfect. And then if I take that quarter wavelength of transmission line at 61 ohms and wrap it into a coil, a number of turns held together with black tape, it's now an RF choke. So now it's a combination of quarter wave matching transformer and poor man's balun. The RF choking characteristic of coiling it together, the quarter wavelength of cable, and that quarter wavelength of cable at the, say for instance, 20 meters, would be something like, I think it's 16 feet long, not counting the velocity factor of the cable. So you get more than enough cable. With velocity factor, it's going to be, I guess, something like 10 or 12 feet long. And you can coil it. And now that RF choke characteristic means that very little current crawls down the outside of the transmission line. If you didn't do that, Mother Nature always wants the dipole to be balanced. In other words, you're connecting the center conductor of the cable to the right-hand side of the dipole. You're connecting the shield of your cable to the left-hand side of the dipole. And Mother Nature always forces that to be a balanced circuit. 100 volts on the right-hand side will be matched with a negative 100 volts on the left side. Therefore, you're putting negative 100 volts, so to speak, at that instant, on the shield of your transmission line. But with this RF choke, that voltage stops right at that coil of cable and doesn't go down the outside of your transmission line and put RF into your shack. K2KEY, K2LIW.
So this is K2KY. Yes, it's evident by just looking at that first diagram and seeing what's happening. Now, let's take another, for instance. Let's say we have a delta loop up there, and it has approximately an impedance of about 300 ohms, and we feed it with 300 ohm twin leads. So we've got now a balanced twin lead of 300 ohms to a 300 ohm antenna. And, well, if we brought that down directly to our transceiver, we would have a bit of a problem, because what would we have? We'd have a 6-to-1 problem there, because the 300 ohm line would be 50. It is the impedance output of our transceiver into 300 would give us a, you know, difference of 6-to-1. However, if by putting a balun or balun or however you want to pronounce it, by applying that type of configuration, what we are doing is basically conforming that. We're taking that balanced antenna system and we are converting it to a 50 ohm and so that it's actually, you know, giving us back to that one-for-one SWR that the transceiver is looking at. So it's, you know, actually, again, let me talk about that SWR business. You know, I noticed 2-to-1 that, you know, with the transceivers cutting back after that 2-to-1. And because in the past, a difference in match between from 75 to 50 ohms was never really something to be considered as a problem years ago, but today it seems to be a very sticking point that everybody wants that 50 ohms to 50 ohms. So basically, your Balaam or Balaam, that's basically what it's doing. And you can see by the chart how basically how everything sort of fits in there along the coax cable, which represents the same thing as happening on the antenna. I think that's what else that I want to say. All right, let me let it back to you. It's getting like this, so we'll continue this. I got one more.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, we're being cut off at noon. Midnight. The bewitching hour. 73, you all. That was segment number 1221 of the Digital Television and Technical Net. We'll be back next week to continue.